labor contract aimed at giving it greater flexibility and competitiveness.
The 74-year-old Italian flag carrier Alitalia is set to fly for the last time on October 15. On the same day, its new incarnation airline, ITA, will start operating with 2,800 employees. More than two-thirds of Alitalia's staff, however, will be laid off. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's Army Ground Forces on Friday launched a military exercise in the northwestern region close to the borders with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. The drill is codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, a reference to the 7th century Battle of Khaybar, in which Prophet Muhammad and his army of early Muslims foiled a plot hatched by Jewish tribes. Iran's Army Ground Forces commander, Brigadier General Kumas Haidari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haidari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however, reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor the Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it's not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S.'s insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including 6 children. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Just above the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee, as many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion losses occurred to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition, in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a bloc of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. the government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching, and also because the conditions of the virus taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The funeral prayers for one of the eight members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the eight were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They kill about eight people, which we are sure that not as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday. They carried away the dead bodies. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid, they paid their salary, and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the eight members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the passing away of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on this day of mourning.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Fatima al-Zahra's lofty position, the 3rd of February, 2021. Regarding Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, even if we adopt an ordinary worldly outlook, perceptive, mystic and spiritual eyes might see other things, of course, we see that the great personality was the Holy Prophet's cherished daughter. As well as this, she is the mother of four radiant ones, two of whom are infallible imams. She is also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet's blessed line. Today, after the passage of 1,400 years, millions of individuals throughout the world are proud of this line. She was the first person in that blessed line. Her life was completely compatible with the date when the Holy Prophet rose to prophethood. In other words, a little after the Holy Prophet's Be'athat, rise to prophethood, she was born. And a little after the Holy Prophet's demise, the end of the Be'athat, her son was set. In other words, her life is completely compatible with the time of the Be'athat. During her childhood, she felt and endured the hardships as a result of spending time in the valley of Abi Talib. In her childhood, she entered the difficult arenas of life. She would miss her mother, which is really difficult for a girl at her age. But as well as enduring those sufferings, she carried out a big task, soothing and consoling the Holy Prophet. The Holy Prophet had lost both Khadija and Abi Talib, and therefore she needed a person by his side. It was his daughter who would console him. This consolation continued to be offered until he went to Medina, and until he engaged in the Battle of Uhud and the Battle of the Trenches and in many other places. The Holy Prophet said Fatima was like a mother for her father. Later on, she had to deal with the hardships stemming from the Hijra period, during which she was subject to difficult tests. After that, she married Ali ibn Abi Talib and had to endure many hardships as he was constantly engaged in the arena of jihad.
Limelight. At the center of AUKUS are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS fact a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere. And AUKUS has global implications. We now present you an article written by Abhishek Prakash, an authority on geopolitics of technology. The piece is titled What AUKUS Means for the World. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. During the Trump administration, a major development took place that went under the radar. Only months after taking office, former U.S. President Donald Trump and his officials started referring to the Asia-Pacific as the Indo-Pacific. This was not by accident. It was a highly strategic and calculated move, one that would kickstart new thinking in Washington. By using the phrase Indo-Pacific, the United States was simultaneously pointing to India's rise and placing new importance on a region that is rapidly becoming the world's new center of gravity. This phrase became even more official when the U.S. military renamed its Pacific Command to U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Jump to 15th of September 2021, and the weight the U.S. is placing on the Indo-Pacific is visible to the world. When President Joe Biden, flanked by the leaders of Britain and Australia, announced AUKUS, a new defense alliance, something else became clear. the new U.S. geopolitical strategy for the next 50 years. That is, Western Europe and West Asia are no longer the priorities. Now Washington is placing all of its attention on and marshalling all of its resources towards dominating the Indo-Pacific. And to achieve this, the United States is turning to technology. At the center of the AUKUS pact are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere in the world. And the AUKUS pact has global implications. But first, attention must be placed on how AUKUS is splitting the West. Already, France has accused the United States of stabbing it in the back. A $40 billion deal for Australia to acquire French submarines is now scrapped. The deal was referred to as the deal of the century. Through AUKUS, Australia will get nuclear-powered submarines from the United States and Britain. Meanwhile, the Canadian media are already questioning why Ottawa was excluded from the pact. Three Canadian government officials have said Canada was not even invited to the talks for AUKUS. And New Zealand has drawn a red line, saying Australian nuclear submarines will not be allowed in its territorial waters. Also expect reactions from Germany, the European Union, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO, all of which may feel the United States is no longer prioritizing European defense. However, regardless of how the West reacts, AUKUS is going ahead. A new technology-based beachhead is being built in the Indo-Pacific that will give the United States and its allies a purported new kind of power. While the first area of work for AUKUS is providing Australia with nuclear-powered submarines, the canvas of the alliance is much, much broader. With a focus on technologies like artificial intelligence and cyber technologies, the possibilities are endless. Could AUKUS establish a new artificial intelligence-based cybersecurity shield? Or will AUKUS establish a new underwater surveillance system in the Indian Ocean using robots similar to what Russia is building? Equally important is what the new US-led geopolitical groups may morph into. Alongside AUKUS, there is the Quad, made up of the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the Quad is far more than just a defense group. This leads to the possibility that the Quad might morph into the next G7, and AUKUS could morph into a new Asian NATO, or the next iteration of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing group. The creation of AUKUS is also a sign that globalization in its current form is ending. In the past, the US and the West created groups that involved everyone, such as the United Nations and the World Trade Organization, WTO. Now globalization is becoming vertical. With technology, the world is starting to divide and fracture. Governments are using technology to establish new walls and new barriers between themselves and the rest of the world. In the vertical world, the new groups only involve like-minded countries, not everyone. This creates a new limit for businesses. Some businesses originating from certain countries may be excluded from participating in the AUKUS Pact or Quad initiatives and projects. Last, as AUKUS takes its first step, it will not only remain in three-nation group. If the unstated goal is to take on China, the alliance has many options. AUKUS could invite Taiwan to the group, creating a new challenge for Beijing. Or AUKUS could invite Indonesia to join, a nation whose future power is largely ignored. By 2050, Indonesia will be the fourth largest economy in the world. Another way to use AUKUS is to interrupt China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, especially the digital BRI, by involving Southeast Asian nations or strategically selecting nations in Central Asia and Eastern Europe. The creation of AUKUS comes at a time when the world is in a period of massive transformation, and it comes as every nation is trying to become a technology power. This new technology-based alliance fundamentally changes global politics. Now, groups like the Group of Seven, the G7, or NATO carry less weight. And traditional US allies like Canada, France, and Germany are becoming outsiders looking in. With technology, AUKUS has the power to supposedly overcome challenges that have plagued other organizations. Whether it be ideology or territory, technology can transcend these differences and barriers. But more than anything else, AUKUS signals that a new race has begun, underpinned by technology. Except, if before this race was only between the United States and China, now it involves many more nations. With technology, the world is rapidly being divided into new tribes. The question is, can these tribes coexist with one another? And if not, what happens next? Prepare for a bumpy ride.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Spotlight.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has urged countries not to rely on foreign powers for their security and not to allow them to interfere in their internal affairs. Ayatollah Khamenei argues that the presence of foreign militaries in this region, including that of the U.S., is a source of destruction and warmongering. He believes that the armed forces of regional countries are able to ensure their own security.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. The leader was addressing a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. He said the armed forces of the regional countries can ensure the security of the region and that they should prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader also spoke about the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and its chaotic withdrawal from the country. A row between France and the U.S. over a security pact in the Asia-Pacific was also among issues mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. Last month, the U.S. and U.K. announced a deal to provide Australia with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. As a result of the trilateral cooperation, a similar Franco-Australian deal worth $40 billion was scrapped. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reacted with fury, calling the agreement a stab in the back. President Emmanuel Macron also urged Europeans to come out of what he called their naivety on the world stage and assert their independence from the United States. Iran's leader set such a spat shows that even European countries, which are not opposed to Washington, feel that there's a deficiency in achieving lasting security because of reliance on the US. America's allies are already looking on with concern at Washington's approach toward France and Afghanistan. The approach is seen as a warning to US allies in East Asia and West Asia and raises the need for them to have plans to cut dependence on the US and explore ways to ensure their own security.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. We have Syed Mohammad Mirandi, University professor and a political analyst in Tehran. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst, is also joining us out of Brussels. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let me start with Professor Mirandi. Which foreign military intervention has been able to secure this region, if you can recall any? Isn't that, therefore, a better idea for countries in West Asia to join hands and try to provide regional security in the absence of foreign powers that have somehow have vested interests?
Absolutely. We've seen the U.S. occupation of Libya. It destroyed the country. The Turkish and American occupation of parts of Syria has only led to death and destruction and devastation. Their support for extremists, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and others have even worsened the situation. The U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, is well known to everyone, and the Saudi destruction of Yemen. And we really have to look at the Israeli regime, though. I think that a lot of what we see in this region would not be happening if it were not for the Israeli regime's existence. If the apartheid regime was not there and it didn't have Western backing, we would not see many of these wars. The Americans are trying to, under different circumstances, manipulate the whole region and thus leading to its destruction. The war to the northwest of Iran, when Armenia invaded Azerbaijanian territory, internationally recognized territory, Iran supported Azerbaijan. In fact, Iran, even under General Haqiqat Pour, trained the resistance in Azerbaijan for them to be able to keep their land. But ironically, the Turkish government put pressure on the Azeri president, and the Iranians were sent home, and the resistance was ended, and the occupation lasted decades. But back then, Iran was opposed to the Armenian attack on Azerbaijan, just as today it will not accept Turkish attack, Erdogan attacking Armenia either. So the problem is that these regimes, these governments, the Americans, the Turk, the Turkish government, the Saudi regime, among others, they have, and of course the Israeli regime, they have just launched war after war after war. Saddam Hussein launched his war against Iran with Western backing. They gave him chemical weapons. And then with Afghanistan, when the Americans created and the Saudis created the extremists to fight the Soviet Union. So they've just been manipulating this region and leading it to utter destruction.
Right. Now, Elijah, Iran has time and again stressed the fact that security cannot be purchased. Do you share the same view?
Absolutely. It is the concern of the people of the region in West Asia and Central Asia to look after their own security, but that can happen only with the talk and the meeting and agreement between the country of the region without a foreign intervention. And it is very possible to do so. We've seen the Iranians talking to the Saudis in Baghdad. We've seen Iranian talking to the Egyptians and the Jordanians, so it's very possible for countries in West Asia and in Central Asia to sit around the table and sort out their differences. The problem always comes up whenever the Americans move in and wants to impose their will and dictate their own policy and their conditions, and this is what's happening today, for example, in Yemen, where the Americans are preventing the Saudi from reaching ceasefire with Ansarullah and lifting all the siege. So wherever the Americans interfere, there is a problem. However, we've seen the performance of the Americans in Afghanistan and how the American forces failed to achieve anything after 20 years. We also have seen the American performance in Iraq. And in 2003, they managed to occupy the country. But then they left, and now the Iraqi resistance is kicking them out. So the people of the region really have enough of foreign intervention. And here it's precisely is the American intervention, but it's not only related to the countries of the region. We see also Europe is trying to create something in separate from the Americans, hegemony and control over the European continent. And that's not going to happen very soon, but what is good is we start hearing voices from France and from Germany and from the European community saying that it is time to detach ourselves a little bit from the Americans, but the Americans are not going to allow that so easily.
Okay. Now, Mohammed, what factors make some states opt for seeking military assistance instead of boosting their own military and armed forces prowess and cater for their security?
For the most part, it is Western countries egging them on. Hmm. The war in Afghanistan was actually created by the Americans. Brzezinski, who is Carter's national security advisor, convinced Carter to support extremists in order to encourage the Soviet Union to enter Afghanistan. In other words, the Americans wanted the Soviets to enter Afghanistan, to invade Afghanistan, so that they can give them a Vietnam. Or, for example, the Americans egged on Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. They and the Europeans gave him chemical weapons, the political cover to use them, and the military intelligence to use them. And then later on, they destroyed Iraq under the pretext of chemical weapons. Or the Americans egg on Erdogan, who's been a very foolish leader. The first decade of his leadership was very good. He had made huge progress in Turkey, and the Turkish people deserved that. And then in the second decade, we've seen him enter Syria, support ISIS and Al-Qaeda. One of your colleagues was murdered on the Turkish border, Serena Şim, when she was reporting that Turkish intelligence was supporting ISIS and that ISIS was using World Food Organization trucks, which belong to the UN, to bring in ISIS troops and supplies.
Right.
And then when she was threatened by Turkish intelligence, she died in an accident hours later at a time when she was worried and she gave a lie before. So the Americans push, or NATO pushes countries like Turkey to destroy Syria, to create tension between Azerbaijan and Armenia for their own ambitions as well, of course. Erdogan's personal ambitions are also important. And then you have Yemen, where the Saudis have destroyed and decimated the country. Then Libya, which we saw despotic regimes, oil-rich regimes, and others supporting the destruction of the country alongside NATO. So a lot of it's because of NATO, and a lot of it is when NATO eggs on regional regimes to do their bidding and make promises to them. But the result is that Saudi Arabia has lost a huge amount of wealth. Turkey under Erdogan, the first decade a huge success, the second decade an utter failure. And we see that European countries have more and more refugees flowing in because of their own policies in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere in this region.
Mm. Okay, now let me ask Elijah, let's look at some specific instances of foreign intervention. Like, let's take a look at Afghanistan, for instance, and see what the U.S.-led foreign force performance was like in that country in the past 20 years. Which of their stated goals were achieved, Elijah? Was terrorism uprooted? Did they make life easier for Afghans, or instead brought them misery and chaos?
After 20 years, during the Taliban, before the occupation of the Americans of Afghanistan, the Taliban movement managed to stop the selling and the production of drugs. And when the Americans arrived, after 20 years, the selling of drugs has increased. The infrastructure all over Afghanistan, at the exception of Kabul, was pitiful. The Al-Qaeda that the Americans came to remove declared their loyalty to the emir of the Taliban movement, and they're still in the country alongside with the Taliban. And nothing has been achieved. All the goals have not been achieved. What has been achieved is the Americans, wherever they go, they appoint responsible and people who are in charge of the state who are corrupted. And this is what has been achieved in Kabul. The Afghan leadership is highly corrupted, and this is what the Americans manage to do always wherever they go in any country they have occupied.
Now, Mohammed, who benefits from wars in other countries? I mean, the crisis of countries or those countries that sell weapons or foreign mercenaries?
Well, it's not the countries that sell weapons. It's the military-industrial complex. They grow increasingly powerful in those countries, and therefore they take more and more of their resources. We see that in the United States itself, where the middle class is being emptied out partially because of perpetual war. And the military-industrial complex is making money out of these wars. They're pushing for wars because they make money that way. And so the American people are not benefiting. In our region as well, it's the military-industrial complex of Western countries mostly that make a great deal of money because they're mostly privately owned. They're privately owned. So when, sadly, Erdogan went into Syria and began funding these terrorist organizations, many factories and companies were making money out of this. Mm-hmm. When the Saudis began their invasion of Yemen and the destruction of the Yemeni infrastructure, hundreds of billions of dollars, along with the UAE, which has been just as criminal in this endeavor, hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons were purchased from the United States, from Canada, from the United Kingdom, from France, and all these countries are just as guilty of crimes against humanity as Erdogan or as Mohammed bin Salman and the others in this region. And of course, there's always the Israeli regime. The ultimate, alongside the military-industrial complex, the ultimate, let's say, benefit goes to the apartheid regime in Palestine, because when you see Libya, which was the most wealthy country in Africa, decimated, who benefits? Mm-hmm. When you see Syria, which was a powerful country in West Asia, when it is broken, who benefits? When Lebanon is brought down by the Americans through economic siege, who benefits? Or in Yemen, or the war, the Saddam Hussein invasion of Iraq, of Iran, or Mr. Erdogan's support for extremists in the Caucasus and elsewhere. It's all of this benefits the Israeli regime, because the more instability there is in our region, the better it is for this regime to be able to sustain itself. But the fact is that the tide has turned, and the United States, NATO, and its allies in this region are losing ground. Erdogan has lost a lot of his popularity, and he's severely damaged his country's economy and credibility. Mohammed bin Salman is not completely sane, and he's driving the Saudi Arabia towards a cliff because they cannot spend forever. The Americans had to leave Afghanistan, the Americans, which are much, much stronger than Saudi Arabia. So can Saudi Arabia continue this war in Yemen forever? Definitely not. So the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot by supporting these different wars or by being involved in these wars. But because the Israeli regime benefits, because the military-industrial complex benefits, that clouds their vision, that clouds their logic and their thinking, and therefore they accept this foolishness, which ultimately will help bring down their empire in this part of the world, and by extension, elsewhere.
Now, Elijah, former President Donald Trump let the cat out of the bag, and regarding American military presence on Syrian soil, he clearly stated America is in Syria, in his own words, to keep the oil. Let's have your take on that.
President Trump declared himself the thief of the Syrian wealth, and particularly oil and gas in the northeast Syria, without feeling any shame. When we heard four-star American generals saying, "We are not pirates, we are professional soldiers," the American president didn't really care about what his generals are saying, because he wanted to stay there. Moreover, the reason why the Americans stay in northeast Syria is to please Israel and to offer to Israel the platform to attack Syria and to attack Iraq, also to prevent the reconstruction of Syria following a decade of war, notwithstanding the fact that today the war is no longer useless. It's useless and no longer reaching any objective. All those belligerents and the countries who supported that war acknowledge that, yet we still have the Americans in the northeast of the country and the Turks occupying the northwest, and they're still there without any purpose but to damage the Syrian population. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the Americans imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria. So there is no purpose. The Americans' behavior have no meaning, and it only reached the damage to the population.
Okay. Mohammed, we have 1 minute. If you could tell me how you look at the prospect of foreign presence in the West Asia region, what's your prediction?
The United States hates the people of this region. That's why they don't care for Christians or Muslims or Shias or Sunnis or Jews. When it's Saddam Hussein, they'll help him because they want to support Israel. They'll destroy him because they think it'll help Israel. They'll destroy Syria, Lebanon, wherever. It's all for Syria. And, of course, the military-industrial complex. Even now in the Caucasus, the Americans were supportive when the Armenians were occupying Azeri towns and villages. And then when the Iranians were supporting them, the Americans and the Turkish government forced the Azeri government to expel the Iranians and end their resistance, leaving that land occupied for decades. And then now the Americans are there encouraging the Turkish government to occupy southern Armenia. Why? Because all of this benefits the Israeli regime. Of course, the Turkish government can't do that. The Iranians won't allow it. But the point is that the Americans don't care if they're Muslims or Christians or Jews. Their manipulation of this region is to weaken the resistance, to strengthen NATO in order to strengthen Israel. And some regimes and some leaders, because of their own personal ambitions and foolishness, or because of their weakness, abide by American policies and are manipulated into pursuing those policies. But as I said, the United States is on the decline, and so are its allies, and so is Israel.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Thank you, my guests, Saeed Mohammad Mirandi, University Professor and Political Analyst in Tehran, and Elijah Magna, Journalist and Political Analyst in Brussels.